Chapter 4. At Tea. Tea was being served in the room that gave on to the veranda where I had that afternoon met Gavrila. I was much perturbed by my uncle's mysterious warnings in regard to the reception awaiting me. Youth is sometimes excessively vain, and youthful vanity is almost always cowardly. And so it was extremely unpleasant for me when, immediately going in at the door and seeing the whole party round the tea-table, I stumbled over a rug, staggered, and, recovering my balance, flew unexpectedly into the middle of the room. As overwhelmed with confusion as though I had at one stroke lost my career, my honour, and my good name, I stood without moving, turning as red as a crab, and looking with a senseless stare at the company. I mention this incident, in itself so trivial, only because of the effect it had on my state of mind during the whole of that day, and consequently my attitude to some of the personages of my story. I tried to bow, did not fully succeed, turned redder than ever, flew up to my uncle, and clutched at his hand. "How do you do, uncle?" I gasped out breathlessly, intending to say something quite different and much cleverer, but to my own surprise I said nothing but, "How do you do?"
"Glad to see you, glad to see you, my boy," answered my uncle, distressed on my account. "You know, we have met already. Don't be nervous, please," he added in a whisper. "It's a thing that may happen to anyone, and worse still, one sometimes falls flat. And now, mother, let me introduce to you. This is our young man. He is a little overcome at the moment, but I am sure you will like him. My nephew, Sergei Alexandrovich," he added, addressing the company.
But before going on with my story, allow me, gentle listener, to introduce to you by name the company in which I suddenly found myself. This is essential to the orderly sequence of my narrative. The party consisted of several ladies and two men, besides my uncle and me. Foma Fomich, whom I was so eager to see, and who, even then, I felt it was absolute monarch in the house, was not there. He was conspicuous by his absence, and seemed to have taken with him all brightness from the room. They all looked gloomy and worried. One could not help noticing it from the first glance. Embarrassed and upset as I was at the moment, I yet discerned that my uncle, for instance, was almost as upset as I was, though he was doing his utmost to conceal his anxiety under a show of ease. Something was lying like a heavy weight on his heart. One of the two gentlemen in the room was a young man about 25, who turned out to be the Obnoskin my uncle had spoken of that afternoon, praising his intelligence and high principles. I did not take to this gentleman at all. Everything about him savoured of vulgar chic. His dress, in spite of its chic, was shabby and common. His face looked somehow shabby, too. His thin flaxen moustaches, like a beetle's whiskers, and his unsuccessful wisps of beard were evidently intended to show that he was a man of independent character and perhaps advanced ideas. He was continually screwing up his eyes, smiling with an affectation of malice. He threw himself into attitudes on his chair and repeatedly stared at me through his eyeglass. But when I turned to him, he immediately dropped his eyeglass and seemed overcome with alarm. The other gentleman was young, too, being about 28. He was my cousin, Mizinchikov. He certainly was extremely silent. He did not utter a single word at tea, and did not laugh when everyone else laughed. But I saw in him no sign of that crushed condition my uncle had detected. On the contrary, the look in his light brown eyes expressed resoluteness and a certain decision of character. Mizinchikov was dark and rather good-looking, with black hair. He was very correctly dressed, at my uncle's expense, as I learned later. Of the ladies, the one I noticed first of all from her spiteful, anemic face was Miss Perepelitsin. She was sitting near Madame la Générale, of whom I will give a special account later, not beside her, but deferentially a little behind. She was continually bending down and whispering something into the ear of her patroness. Two or three elderly lady companions were sitting absolutely mute in a row by the window, gazing open-eyed at Madame la Générale and waiting respectfully for their tea. My attention was attracted also by a fat, absolutely redundant lady of about 50, dressed very tastelessly and gaudily, wearing rouge, I believe, though she had hardly any teeth except blackened and broken stumps. This fact did not, however, prevent her from mincing, screwing up her eyes, dressing in the height of fashion, and almost making eyes. She was hung round with chains, and, like Monsieur Obnoskin, was continually turning her lorgnette on me. This was his mother. Praskovya Ilyinichna, my meek aunt, was pouring out the tea. She obviously would have liked to embrace me after our long separation, and of course to have shed a few tears on the occasion, but she did not dare. Everything here was, it seemed, under rigorous control. Near her was sitting a very pretty, black-eyed girl of 15, who looked at me intently, with childish curiosity, my cousin Sashenka. Finally, and perhaps most conspicuous of all, was a very strange lady, dressed richly and extremely youthfully, though she was far from being in her first youth, and must have been at least 35. Her face was very thin, pale and withered, but extremely animated. A bright colour was constantly appearing in her pale cheeks, almost at every movement, at every flicker of feeling. She was in continual excitement, twisting and turning in her chair, and seemed unable to sit still for a minute. She kept looking at me with a kind of greedy curiosity, and was continually bending down to whisper something into the ear of Sashenka, or of her neighbour on the other side, and immediately afterwards laughing in the most childish and simple-hearted way. But to my surprise, her eccentricities seemed to pass unnoticed by the others, as though they had all agreed to pay no attention to them. I guessed that this was Tatiana Ivanovna, the lady in whom, to use my uncle's expression, there was something phantasmagorial, whom they were trying to force upon him as a bride, and whose favour almost everyone in the house was trying to court for the sake of her money. But I liked her eyes, blue and mild, and though there were already crow's feet round the eyes, their expression was so simple-hearted, so merry and good-humoured, that it was particularly pleasant to meet them. Of Tatiana Ivanovna, one of the real heroines of my story, I shall speak more in detail later. Her history was very remarkable. 5 minutes after my entrance, a very pretty boy, my cousin Ilyusha, ran in from the garden, with his pockets full of knuckle-bones and a top in his hand. He was followed by a graceful young girl, rather pale and weary-looking, but very pretty. She scanned the company with a searching, mistrustful and even timid glance, looked intently at me, and sat down by Tatiana Ivanovna. I remember that I could not suppress a throb at my heart. I guessed that this was the governess. I remember, too, that on her entrance my uncle stole a swift glance at me and flushed crimson. Then he bent down, caught up Ilyusha in his arms, and brought him up to me to be kissed. I noticed, too, that Madame Obnoskin first stared at my uncle and then, with a sarcastic smile, turned her lorgnette on the governess. My uncle was very much confused, and, not knowing what to do, was on the point of calling to Sashenka to introduce her to me. But the girl merely rose from her seat, and, in silence, with grave dignity, dropped me a curtsy. I liked her doing this, however, for it suited her. At the same instant, my kindly aunt, Praskovya Ilyinichna, could hold out no longer, and, abandoning the tea tray, dashed up to embrace me. But before I had time to say a couple of words to her, I heard the shrill voice of Miss Perepolitsyn hissing out that Praskovya Ilyinichna seemed to have forgotten Madame la Générale. "Madame has asked for her tea, and you do not pour it out, and she is waiting." And Praskovya Ilyinichna, leaving me, flew back in all haste to her duties. Madame la Générale, the most important person of the party, in whose presence all the others were on their best behaviour, was a lean, spiteful old woman, dressed in mourning. Spiteful, however, chiefly from old age, and from the loss of her mental faculties, which had never been over-brilliant. Even in the past she had been a nonsensical creature. Her rank as a general's wife had made her even stupider and more arrogant. When she was in a bad humour, the house became a perfect hell. She had two ways of displaying her ill-humour. The first was a silent method, when the old lady would not open her lips for days together, but maintained an obstinate silence, and pushed away, or even sometimes flung on the floor, everything that was put before her. The other method was the exact opposite, garrulous. This would begin, as a rule, by my grandmother's, for she was my grandmother, of course, being plunged into a state of extreme despondency, and expecting the end of the world and the failure of all her undertakings, foreseeing poverty and every possible trouble in the future, being carried away by her own presentiments, reckoning on her fingers the calamities that were coming, and reaching a climax of enthusiasm and intense excitement over the enumeration. It always appeared, of course, that she had foreseen all this long before, and had said nothing only because she was forced to be silent in this house. But if only she had been treated with respect, if only they had cared to listen to her earlier, then, etc., etc. In all this, the flock of lady companions and Miss Perepolitsyn promptly followed suit, and finally it was solemnly ratified by Foma Fomitch. At the minute when it was presented to her, she was in a horrible rage, and apparently it was taking the silent form, the most terrible. Everyone was watching her with apprehension. Only Tatiana Ivanovna, who was completely unconscious of it all, was in the best of spirits. My uncle purposely, with a certain solemnity, led me up to my grandmother, but the latter, making a wry face, pushed away her cup ill-humouredly.
"Is this that Volti girl?" she drawled through her teeth, addressing Miss Perepolitsyn.
This foolish question completely disconcerted me. I don't understand why she called me a voltigeur, but such questions were easy enough to her. Miss Perepolitsyn bent down and whispered something in her ear, but the old lady waved her off angrily. I remained standing with my mouth open and looked inquiringly at my uncle. They all looked at one another, and Obnoskin even grinned, which I did not like at all.
"She sometimes talks at random, my boy,"
my uncle, a little disconcerted himself, whispered in my ear.
"But it means nothing. It's just her goodness of heart. The heart is what one must look at."
"Yes, the heart! The heart!"
Tatiana Ivanovna's bell-like voice rang out. She had not taken her eyes off me all this time, and seemed as though she could not sit still in her chair. I suppose the word heart, uttered in a whisper, had reached her ear. But she did not go on, though she was evidently longing to express herself. Whether she was overcome with confusion or some other feeling, she suddenly subsided into silence, flushed extremely red, turned quickly to the governess and whispered something in her ear, and, suddenly putting her handkerchief before her mouth and sinking back in her chair, began giggling as though she were in hysterics. I looked at them all in extreme amazement. But to my surprise, everyone was particularly grave and looked as though nothing exceptional had happened. I realized, of course, the kind of person Tatiana Ivanovna was. At last I was handed tea, and I recovered myself a little. I don't know why, but I suddenly felt that it was my duty to begin a polite conversation with the ladies. "It was true what you told me, uncle," I began, "when you warned me that I might be a little abashed. I openly confess. Why conceal it?" I went on, addressing Madame Obnoskin with a deprecating smile, "that I have hitherto had hardly any experience of ladies' society. And just now, when I made my entry so unsuccessfully, it seemed to me that my position in the middle of the room was very ridiculous and made me look rather a simpleton, didn't it? Have you read The Simpleton?" I added, feeling more and more lost, blushing at my ingratiating candour, and glaring at Monsieur Obnoskin, who was still looking me up and down, with a grin on his face.
"Just so, just so, just so!" my uncle cried suddenly with extreme animation, genuinely delighted that the conversation had been set going somehow, and that I had recovered myself. "That's no great matter, my boy. You're talking of the likelihood of your being abashed. Well, you have been, and that's the end of it. But when I first made my debut, I actually told a lie, my boy. Would you believe that? Yes, really, Anfisa Petrovna, I assure you it's worth hearing. Just after I had become a Junker, I went to Moscow and presented myself to a very important lady with a letter of introduction. That is, she was a very haughty woman, but in reality very good-natured, in spite of what they said. I went in. I was shown up. The drawing-room was full of people, chiefly swells. I made my bow and sat down. At the second word, she asked me, 'Have you estates in the country?' And I hadn't got as much as a hen. What was I to answer? I felt crushed to the earth. Everyone was looking at me. I was only a young Junker. Why not say, 'No, I have nothing,' and that would have been the right thing, because it was the truth, but I couldn't face it. 'Yes,' I said, 117 serfs.' And why did I stick on that 17? If one must tell a lie, it is better to tell it with a round number, isn't it? A minute later, through my letter of introduction, it appeared that I was as poor as a church mouse, and I had told a lie into the bargain. Oh, well, there was no help for it. I took myself off as fast as I could, and never set foot in the place again. In those days I had nothing, you know. All I have got now is 300 serfs from Uncle Afanasy Matveyevich, and 200 serfs with Kapitanovko, which came to me earlier from my grandmother Akulina Panfilovna, a total of more than 500 serfs. That's capital. But from that day I gave up lying, and don't tell lies now.'
'Well, I shouldn't have given it up if I were you. There's no knowing what may happen,' observed Obnoskin, smiling ironically.
'To be sure, that's true. Goodness knows what may happen,' my uncle assented good-naturedly.
Obnoskin burst into loud laughter, throwing himself back in his chair. His mother smiled. Miss Perepolitsyn sniggered in a particularly disgusting way. Tatyana Ivanovna giggled too, without knowing why, and even clapped her hands. In fact, I saw distinctly that my uncle counted for nothing in his own house. Sashenka's eyes flashed angrily, and she looked steadily at Obnoskin. The governess flushed and looked down. My uncle was surprised.
"What is it? What's happened?"
he repeated, looking round at us all in perplexity. All this time, my cousin Mizinchikov was sitting a little way off, saying nothing and not even smiling when everyone laughed. He drank tea zealously, gazed philosophically at the whole company, and several times, as though in an access of unbearable boredom, broke into whistling, probably a habit of his, but pulled himself up in time. Obnoskin, who had jeered at my uncle and had attempted to attack me, seemed not to dare to glance at Mizinchikov. I noticed that. I noticed, too, that my silent cousin looked frequently at me, and with evident curiosity, as though he was trying to make up his mind what sort of person I was.
"I am certain," Madame Obnoskin minced suddenly. "I am perfectly certain, Monsieur Sergei, that is your name, I believe, that at home in Petersburg you were not greatly devoted to the ladies. I know that there are many, a great many young men nowadays in Petersburg who shun the society of ladies altogether. But in my opinion, they are all free thinkers. Nothing would induce me to regard it as anything but unpardonable free thinking. And I must say it surprises me, young man, it surprises me, simply surprises me."
"I have not been into society at all," I answered with extraordinary animation. "But that, I imagine, at least, is of no consequence. I have lived, that is, I have generally had lodgings, but that is no matter, I assure you. I shall be one day, but hitherto I have always stayed at home."
"He is engaged in learned pursuits," observed my uncle, drawing himself up with dignity.
"Oh, uncle, still talking of your learned pursuits. Only fancy," I went on, with an extraordinary free and easy air, smirking affably and again addressing Madame Obnoskin, "my beloved uncle is so devoted to learning that he has unearthed somewhere on the high road a marvellous practical philosopher, a Mr. Korovkin. And his first words to me, after all these years of separation, were that he was expecting this phenomenal prodigy with the most acute, one may say, impatience. From love of learning, of course." And I sniggered, hoping to provoke a general laugh at my facetiousness.
"Who is that? Of whom is he talking?"
Madame la Générale jerked out sharply, addressing Miss Perepelitsin.
"Yegor Ilyich has been inviting visitors, learned gentlemen. He drives along the high road collecting them,"
the lady hissed out. My uncle was completely dumbfounded.
"Oh, yes, I had forgotten," he cried,
turning upon me a glance that expressed reproach.
"I am expecting Korovkin, a man of learning, a man who will survive his century—"
He broke off and relapsed into silence. Madame la Générale waved her arm, and this time so successfully that she knocked over a cup, which flew off the table and was smashed. General excitement followed.
"She always does that when she is angry. She throws things on the floor,"
my uncle whispered in confusion.
"But she only does it when she is angry. Don't stare, my boy. Don't take any notice. Look the other way. What made you speak of Korovkin?"
But I was looking away already. At that moment I met the eyes of the governess, and it seemed to me that in their expression there was something reproachful, even contemptuous. A flush of indignation glowed upon her pale cheeks.
I understood the look in her face, and guessed that, by my mean and disgusting desire to make my uncle ridiculous in order to make myself a little less so, I had not gained much in that young lady's estimation. I cannot express how ashamed I felt.
"I must go on about Petersburg with you," Anfisa Petrovna gushed again, when the commotion caused by the breaking of the cup had subsided. "I recall with such enjoyment, I may say, our life in that charming city. We were very intimately acquainted with a family. Do you remember, Pavel, General Polovitsyn? Oh, what a fascinating, fascinating creature his wife was! You know that aristocratic distinction, beau monde. Tell me, you have most likely met her. I must own I have been looking forward to your being here with impatience. I have been hoping to hear a great deal, a very great deal, about our friends in Petersburg.
I am very sorry that I cannot... Excuse me, as I have said already, I have rarely been into society, and I don't know General Polovitsyn. I have never even heard of him, I answered impatiently, my affability being suddenly succeeded by a mood of extreme annoyance and irritability.
He is studying mineralogy,
my incorrigible uncle put in with pride.
Is that investigating all sorts of stones? Mineralogy, my boy?
Yes, uncle, stones.
There are a great many sciences, and they are all of use. And do you know, my boy, to tell you the truth, I did not know what mineralogy meant. It's all Greek to me. In other things I am so-so, but at learned subjects I am stupid. I frankly confess it.
"You frankly confess!" Obnoskin caught him up with a snigger.
"Papa!" cried Sashenka, looking reproachfully at her father.
"What is it, darling? Oh, dear, I keep interrupting you, Anfisa Petrovna!"
My uncle caught himself up suddenly, not understanding Sashenka's exclamation.
"Please forgive me!" "Oh, don't distress yourself!"
Anfisa Petrovna answered with a sour smile.
"Though I have said everything already to your nephew, and will finish, perhaps, Monsieur Sergei, that is right, isn't it, by telling you that you really must reform. I believe that the sciences, the arts, sculpture, for instance, all those lofty ideas, in fact, have their fascinating side, but they do not take the place of ladies. Women would form you, young man, and so to do without them is impossible, young man. Impossible, impossible.
Impossible, impossible.
Tatyana Ivanovna's rather shrill voice rang out again.
"Listen,"
she began, speaking with a sort of childish haste, and flushing crimson, of course.
"Listen, I want to ask you something."
"Pray do," I answered, looking at her attentively.
"I wanted to ask you whether you have come to stay long or not."
"I really don't know. That's as my affairs—"
"Affairs? What sort of affairs can he have? Oh, the mad fellow!"
And Tatyana Ivanovna, blushing perfectly crimson and hiding behind her fan, bent down to the governess and at once began whispering something to her. Then she suddenly laughed and clapped her hands.
"Stay! Stay!"
she cried, breaking away from her confidant and again addressing me in a great hurry, as though afraid I were going away.
"Listen, do you know what I'm going to tell you? You are awfully, awfully like a young man, a fascinating young man. Sashenka, Nastenka, do you remember? He's awfully like that madman. Do you remember, Sashenka? We were out driving when we met him, on horseback in a white waistcoat. He put up his eyeglass at me, too. Oh, the shameless fellow. Do you remember? I hid myself in my veil, too, but I couldn't resist putting my head out of the carriage window and shouting to him, 'You shameless fellow!' And then I threw my bunch of flowers on the road. Do you remember, Nastenka?"
and the lady, half crazy over eligible young men, hid her face in her hands, all excitement. Then suddenly leaped up from her seat, darted to the window, snatched a rose from a bowl, threw it on the floor near me, and ran out of the room. She was gone in a flash. This time, a certain embarrassment was apparent, though Madame la Générale was again completely unmoved. Anfissa Petrovna, for instance, showed no surprise, but seemed suddenly a little troubled, and looked with anxiety at her son. The young ladies blushed, while Pavel Obnoskin, with a look of vexation which at the time I did not understand, got up from his chair and went to the window. My uncle was beginning to make signs to me, but at that instant another person walked into the room and drew the attention of all.
"Ah, here is Yevgrav Larionitch! Oh, talk of angels!"
cried my uncle, genuinely delighted.
"Well, brother, have you come from the town?"
Queer set of creatures. They seem to have been collected here on purpose, I thought to myself, not yet understanding fully what was passing before my eyes, and not suspecting either that I was probably adding another to the collection of queer creatures by appearing among them.